Welcome to Series 5 of My Life in Design, brought to you by the DBA and design-focused PR agency Red Setter. I'm Claire Blythe, co-founder of Red Setter. In this series, I'll be speaking to more people who are shaping the world of design, finding out how they discovered that design was a thing you could base a career around, and how they got to where they are today. This week, I'm here with Joy Nazari, founder of DNCO. They've worked on projects such as the recent rebranding of six London Overground lines, neighbourhood branding in London, Edinburgh, Birmingham, and most recently the city of San Francisco, so wayfinding in the European Quarter in Brussels, the V&A, Natural History Museum and Television Centre, which is the BBC's original headquarters. Joy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Very excited to be here.
Can I talk about when you first realised that I suppose having a creative career was possible?
So I probably didn't exactly think of it in that way.
Yeah.
But I was really fortunate because my mother spent a long time at Landor and Addison in the 80s.
Right. Okay. What did she do? What's her?
So account management side, I mean, run around generally. My memory of her was constantly running around, actually traveling internationally. She speaks multiple languages. So she was very much a doer and a shaker and very active with that role. But as a kid, my memory is of running through variously the Klamath. As if you know, that's Landor's original headquarters, was
right.
A ship.
Okay.
And she worked on the Klamath.
It was a ship? I didn't know that.
It was a ship. Ship is quite a grand word, but it was a big boat.
Wow.
It was a very big boat. And that's for years, and I don't know whether or not they have this anymore, but certainly for many, many years, they had this. The Klamath was part of their mark.
Right.
And as a kid, I ran around that ship. And it was a remarkable place to witness as a child.
That must have been this exciting. God, I remember going to my dad's office and it was the most boring place in the world.
Well,
so going to your mum's.
This was not boring. This was, I think, a golden era of watching people cut out the Coca-Cola logo to stick it in fluoro pink on a can to see what that was going to look like.
Wow.
At the top of the Klamath, sort of where the captain maybe would have been when it was an actual working ship, they had a museum, a packaging museum, and I would just peer into these glass cabinets thinking, wow, these things that are, you know, so old, like really old forms of packaging. It was a phenomenal experience.
Yeah.
So I suppose I knew, and I also twice visited Walter Landor's home.
Wow.
He had a big house in Napa, and my mum was very friendly with him. And I remember thinking at the time, gosh, this is a very successful man. And I probably only many years later realized, oh, wow, that industry is a viable
it's a thing.
Career is a thing.
So is all in San Francisco?
This is in San Francisco the greater Bay Area. And I think Walter's had a place in Napa. So that's where he would have corporate dues out there. And
I've definitely
collected Easter eggs once. giant Easter egg hunt in his house.
That's so cool.
It was cool. And so, you know, my mom, she used to point out in San Francisco, oh, Landor worked on that. So for example, my favorite identity in the world is the Muni logo of the tram system in San Francisco. And that was designed by Walter or Walter's team in the 70s.
Wow.
Actually, quite famously, they were paid $100,000 for that in the 70s.
Wow.
And I think that was really good value looking back at it now.
It's still the same one that's out there today.
It's still there today.
God, that's amazing.
It's totally beautiful. Yeah.
It's really beautiful.
It's a real artwork. So
So
that I had that all as a very early experience. Mm. I didn't then go into any path that I thought that's what I want to do. It just was, it was there in the background. I pursued totally different careers, really.
So what did you do then? Was it, so you weren't particularly thinking at school, I really want to get involved in this and do art and design and that side of it. It was more.
Correct.
What did you do?
It's a bit of a shame. And I look back a lot. So I grew up without a television and my mother.
Did you?
I did. Yeah.
Oh my God. I want to know more about that.
I don't know what I did with my time, but I was also a latchkey kid. So I'd come home and, you know, there's no TV. So my mum would go and she would buy butcher paper. So the giant rolls that they would have as butcher rolls. And she mounted it onto the wall with a curtain rod. And I would draw on that all the time. So a little bit of me sort of thinks to her, you know, maybe you could have, you know, encouraged that to continue after the drawing stick figures stage, but it didn't happen. And in the end, I went into economics. I studied economics at university. Super interested in business. So the creative thing slightly disappeared from my head.
But the economic side is obviously very, very important, having that grounding of,
Completely. And my view generally is that everyone is a creative in some form, even if you're not in the creative industries, you're using creativity to problem solve, to innovate. Yeah. And that's those skills are there, and they show up in so many different ways. So I think I'm using creativity in a lot of different ways, even before I entered the industry. But yeah, so I studied economics and went into finance. I started my career in investment banking, unbelievably.
Was this around California still?
Still, yeah, in California, and this will date me terribly, but it was during the dot-com boom. So everyone was, you know, it was all about tech startups, and it still feels like it's about tech startups, but then it was like that was... I'm not even sure we quite had that as a phrase.
It's like big website startups, really, wasn't it?
Yes.
Rather than that.
And, but exactly. Yeah. It was just websites. It was just stuff that you received, as opposed to, you know, we didn't have anything peer-to-peer yet. I definitely ordered flowers in 1996, I think, online. That was my first transaction. I think it was Interflora. I sent my mom some flowers. I was in university. And so that was really early days.
This is
what I'm doing is really like rock and roll. I'm ordering flowers online using a credit card. So I'm pretty sure none of it was secure. You know, it was very dodgy times. But I started in tech, investment banking, and then in tech. So that was a very unusual, I suppose, start given where I am now. I'm a bit of an oddity, I think, in the creative world from where I started to where I am.
But I like that. I think that's one of the many reasons I wanted you to come on the podcast, because I knew your background's quite different and you don't have to go to design school and that side of it to end up in the position that you are now.
No, and I'm really pleased now. I'm old enough and reconciled, I think, enough to be able to say, without any embarrassment, I didn't go to design school. And I have enough mileage on the odometer to be okay and to be square with that. I think...
Did you used to have a problem with it? Did you feel like you wouldn't...
I think there are certain rooms where you have people you sort of think, gosh, that person is such an incredible talent, and they've been drawing and doodling, and that's been their entire existence, and then they've made a career out of it. And that definitely hasn't been mine. But my specific career was around, I love problem solving. I can't leave a problem alone.
Yeah.
So if I see something that needs to be tackled, or I see an opportunity, I think let's do that thing. And let's do that thing, and let's wrap creative people around it. So I think that's probably where I have created a career. Is there's a problem or there's an opportunity, let's grab that and make a thing out of it, and hey, let's put some really great creative people together. So that's I suppose my role's been.
So you're working in the financial side and sort of banking, and what kind of...
So I worked in banking. I was analyzing, I was doing equity research, so
right.
Sort of super geeky, high geek stuff. I would love to, if anyone wants to pay me a compliment, they should call me a geek. It's like the ultimate thing that I want to be known as. And like, geekiness is for me wonderful. Everyone should love their inner geek.
Definitely.
So I definitely started with being a bit of a finance geek. All my friends were doing really well in the startup world, and I thought, well, that looks really great. So I jumped into a startup, actually one that was owned by Amazon, or got bought by Amazon. And
what was it? What's it?
So it was called Alexa, funnily enough.
Oh, but nothing to do with the voice?
I suspect, and I might be wrong, but I suspect the reason they called the machine thing Alexa, because they had that as a trademark.
Yes.
But Alexa was named after Alexandria, obviously the books, etc., the knowledge, I should say, and it was before there was Google, there was Alexa, and Alexa cached the whole internet.
Really?
And they had an incredible business. Yeah, it was fantastic. They had, there was some really silly thing. I remember being in their server room and they were like, we've got 3 whole terabytes of data in here, Joy. And it's like a room full of machines. Now we look at that now, you can practically carry that around in your pocket.
Yeah, definitely.
At the time it was like, wow, I might've been 20 terabytes. It doesn't matter. It was still so little relative to what we have now. But you still would be aware of them if you've ever used the Wayback Machine.
No.
So the Wayback Machine is, you can look at websites as they were in different periods of time.
Right, okay.
And that's the charitable side that's came sort of spun out of Alexa. Alexa was providing data that you could look at website data when you were on Internet Explorer. So it's sort of high geek. They also had a research department that would tell you, oh, everyone's Googling about this particular toy. So then big toy manufacturers would want to know and buy that research. Of course, Amazon wanted to own all of that, so they bought that company. So
interesting.
So that was a really cool experience. And I was at the same time really aware of this strange homogeneity that was going on in San Francisco at the time. San Francisco is such a cool city.
Yeah, I love it.
It's had its deeply serious troubles in recent times. It has a history of homelessness, but obviously that seems to have come to the fore in recent times.
Absolutely, yeah.
But at the time, I was just this weird time in San Francisco where everyone was working for a .com, and the first question you would ask somebody or you would be asked is, what are your stock options? And I just thought it was this strange bubble.
Yeah.
And I just became obsessed with leaving, but leaving entirely. So I started speaking to recruitment consultants and I said, I want to work for a tech company, but I want to work abroad. I kind of don't care. Tokyo, London, São Paulo, just send me somewhere away. I don't want to be in this weird bubble.
Yes.
And I did end up getting a job taking a huge Kleiner Perkins funded startup to London. I was one of 3 people that came to London to do that startup. And it was called Elance. And Elance doesn't exist anymore, but it was a freelance platform where you could buy freelance time to do anything. You still have all these Upwork. I think they've all been rolled up. In fact, I think maybe Elance even was rolled up into Upwork at some point. But great company, great idea, just way too soon. I think people were not ready to do B2B transactions like that online. I think we're much more willing now.
Yeah, definitely.
To do that. So hilariously, that job, I mean, it was wonderful. They sent me here, they shipped all my furniture over. I had this great flat. I was like, this is phenomenal. I've got this career in London now. And that was 2000. And in 2001, the bubble, of course, famously burst.
Yeah.
So they said, you need to retrench to California. And I said, well, you know, NFW, I'm not going back there. I want to stay in London. London's really cool. And so I was jobless.
Wow. Okay. So you just thought, that's it, I'll stay.
That's it. 24 years old and jobless. And I just said, oh, I like London though. I'm going to just give it a go, which was a huge risk because the market that, you know, the dot-com bubble felt like the global financial crisis felt, you know, it was high risk. Everyone felt mass insecurity. And looking back, it was, should have been a terrifying time. But you know, I think when you're 24, everything is kind of like, this is fine. This is going to be fine.
Yeah, that's how I was, definitely.
Yeah, this is going to be great. So I was lucky when I moved to London, I knew one person. I literally didn't know anybody. That one person was a woman who worked with my mum in Landor and Addison. Mm-hmm. And she's older than me and younger than my mum, so she's sort of in between us. And she sort of adopted me and said, come on, let's sort you out. And she introduced me to recruitment consultants and she mentored me. And actually what she really did was she sat me down and treated me as if she was interviewing me.
Oh, wow.
And made me, so she'd say, well, how would you answer this question? And I would say, well, that's how I'd answer. She's like, no, pretend she would make me literally say and pretend that she was the interviewer.
Oh, that's so useful.
It was great. So I had to role play with her and I found it really difficult, but it meant that, I mean, she had no reason other than like mass kindness to do this for me. But this one individual, so her name is Liz Dunning. Mm-hmm. She had a tremendous career in brand and then set up her own agency. And she set up her own agency maybe about 10 years before Ben and I set up DNCO. Mm-hmm. And anyway, she got me a job, which was a design-related agency, but starting a piece of software, a sort of small software subsidiary for them. And that is the really weird route for how I got into design.
Wow.
Was going in and starting this tech company in the context of a design agency, which then had an ailing sister company, mm-hmm. which I was at the ridiculous age of 26 asked to be the managing director.
Wow, okay.
And being totally naive, I said, yeah, I can do that. I'll give that a try. So the rest is more or less history.
How did it go? What did you do there? And I'm really fascinated at all the sort of steps involved.
So the company was Hayes Davidson, which is an architectural visualization company.
Yeah.
The man who founded Hayes Davidson is called Alan Davidson, mm-hmm. and he's no longer around, but he's died, unfortunately, a few years ago from motor neuron disease, but one of the most influential people in my life. He was a tremendous artist. Mm. You know, he could draw like no one I have ever seen be able to draw before. It just poured out of him. It was so inspiring to watch. You might have an idea, but he could just instantly visualize it. Mm. And more or less, Alan was the guy who invented CGIs for architecture. So he was the first to use computing power very early on to take CAD and turn it into an architectural visualization. So he was a real
pioneer.
It was incredible. But he's a real polymath. He was very smart. He was a very difficult man, by the way, to work with. And that in itself, I learned a lot from that.
Yeah, absolutely.
He had this thing which I really loved too, which is he liked to spin up companies. So he had Hayes Davidson, which is still going today as an employee-owned company, which I think is the ultimate testament to building a great business is that it exists post your death. I think that's phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, that's a real goal.
Absolutely.
I really admire that, looking at that. And then he started a design agency, and then he started this software company, which I helped him do. And I had this really arrogant sort of 26-year-old overconfident moment where I said, I'm bored of this software company. I want to run all the marketing for all the different companies. And he said, you know, Joy, that's not really a role. But why don't you try and improve the results of this little fledgling design agency we've started called One Space Design. And that's where I met Ben Dale, who was the creative director of that company.
Right, okay.
And so we spent a few years that became a successful company in its own right. Design for architects and the built environment. Mostly focused on real estate. Mm-hmm. In fact, entirely focused on real estate. Very, very niche.
Yeah.
And we woke up one day and thought, gosh, you know, we've got 20% of the business and he's got 80.
Yeah.
And we're doing all of the work. And we sort of thought, can we get ourselves out of this situation so that it's in the future is a bit better for us? And we asked him if he would be up for us doing a management buyout. And he said, yeah, I think I'd be up for that. He came up with some terms. The terms were very beneficial to him.
Yes.
And which is, you know, too, right? We were trading off the back of things that he had spent decades building. Mm-hmm. And in the end, Ben and I had a few beers and we said, you know, why don't we just not pay him for that? And why don't we just start from zero ourselves and just build it the way we want to build it?
Yeah.
And I look back at that and I think, I just don't know how we did that or we managed that moment.
That sort of sliding doors thing, isn't it? Where what would have happened in this? But obviously this has been amazing and successful, but
I'm glad we didn't do door number one.
Yeah.
I'm glad we said no to that. The easy thing would have been to say, let's continue that other thing. The hard thing was to start again from zero. I think to add an extra layer to it, Ben had a partner and two children. They were really young. I was footloose and fancy free. I think I was mostly single then and certainly didn't have kids yet. So for me, the risk was nothing.
Yeah.
Basically. And for him, the risk was massive. And I'm not sure, looking back now, I think you were mad to hitch your, you know, trailer to me. I think that's incredible. I really...
Clearly not.
Well, thank you. I mean, thank you for that. I appreciate that. It was, well, but I wouldn't have been able to do anything without him either. We were a really good pair. He had all the creative standing, you know, Central St. Martins. He'd worked in the architecture industry. He knew what he was talking about.
Yeah.
I had all the bluster and the bravado and the negotiation skills and optimism.
All the finance side of that. That's really important in a business.
And the finance side. That's true. That's
definitely
true. So that worked out really, really well. But we started in my front room in Balham.
Yeah.
The biggest and only expense we did at the time was an £80 printer.
Yeah.
And it was, we thought it was such a great thing that we'd spent the whole £80 on a printer. And we had decided on DN and Co. as a name.
Yeah.
And I had spotted that dnco.com as a URL was available. Well, it wasn't available. It was bought by American Express and they weren't using it. It was redirecting it to americanexpress.com. I kid you not, I don't know, I was so brave back then. I'm not sure I would be able to do this today, but I rang the main number for the headquarters of American Express in the US and said, please, can I speak to your CTO? And they said, sure, no problem. Just one moment, ma'am. And they transferred me over to this guy picks up the phone and goes, hello.
In the days where you could actually get through to people on the phone, yes. And they would put, yeah.
Yes,
it's
exactly.
Amazing though.
And I said, hello, my name is Joy. You guys own dnco.com. Can we buy it from you? And he said these exact words. He said, Joy, I have no idea how you got to my phone number, but I am going to say to you right now, $5,000. And if you don't say yes, I'm going to hang up and you're never going to reach me again. And so I had to commit on the spot, having only ever purchased an £80
God,
printer.
Then all of a sudden you've got $5,000 of going.
And I looked at Ben and I said, and I just looked at the, I just spoke into the phone. Okay. You know, we'll spend $5,000. So about, at the time it was about £3,000. And I immediately rang my mum and said, do you mind, please, kindly, can you give us a loan? And so what's it for? And blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, you know, you'll own this domain and it's going to have value one day.
Yeah.
And so, I love to say to her to this day, she's turning 80 next year.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
That you were our first investor only investor. And it took us about 3 years, but eventually we did pay her back for the £3,000 loan for dnco.com. And today I'm so pleased we have that URL.
Definitely.
It's really nice. So those were the major decisions.
That's such a cool way of getting the URL. That's amazing.
But I'd love to find that guy one day and just be like, it was one of the most amazing phone calls where he just said, I have no idea how you got to me, but it's $5,000 or I'm hanging up. Just get out of my hair.
That's really amazing. I'm glad he did.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's those moments you have to just take a deep breath and call people and say,
yeah,
I want this thing. What do you think?
Definitely.
So I think that's a useful bit of advice.
So how did you start the business? What were the early stages? Like, how did you get new clients?
We were without a doubt really lucky.
Mm.
We had two phone calls even before we had incorporated. One was from a very good friend of mine who said, oh, I know this guy. I'm freelancing for him. He's starting a brand in Switzerland. It's going to be called Alpine Homes. Don't you do something like this? Is this sort of what you do? And I said, yes, this is sort of what we do. And so we had that as a project straight away. I think we weren't even incorporated as a business.
Wow, that's brilliant.
Which was really cool. And the other phone call was from a former client saying, I just rang to try and catch you at HaysDavidson/OneSpaceDesign. And they said, you're not there. And she called me on my mobile and she said, where are you? And I said, oh, well, we're starting a new gig. And so that was a pitch, which then we won. And those two projects were basically enough for Ben and I sat down and said, well, how much do you need to survive? How much do you need to survive? And we agreed a number. And we sort of said, well, if we plus the little minimal expenses of getting paper for the printer, travel costs, that together should be, you know, should 1 or 2 years of that to start to develop a portfolio and, you know, we'll be away.
Yeah.
So that's how we did the maths. And actually that's how we did the maths forever together, was just this open conversation of,
yeah,
you know, what does it take to be nominally happy and to feel okay about things? Yeah. And then if it's more than that, then hey, that's pretty cool.
Definitely. Yeah. That's a good way of doing it.
Yeah, so that was good.
How did you split roles? So he was in the creative and you weren't, but what did you do? What did your roles look like?
So early on, we both did a lot of things.
Mm.
My role has probably always been a lot of new business.
Yeah.
That's definitely, you know, I had the microphone.
Yeah.
And I had Ben in the background, not in the background, in the foreground, but next to me sort of saying, this is actually, that's Joy. It needs to be this actually. So he had the real depth of experience. And I think that's an important reflection, I think, over my career is in any situation, you alone can't do it all. You've got to
definitely
put together the teams that can deliver the thing that's in front of you. You can't do it on your own. But notionally, new business, I was naturally gravitating towards. I was excited. I was like, let's go and grab that piece of business.
Mm-hmm.
Strategy is something I'm very passionate about. Generally, yeah. I think you're at X and you want to be at X plus, you know, one.
Yeah.
How do you move that needle? And I like figuring that out and then pulling people together and figuring that out together and using design, using words to do that, I think is a really rewarding career.
Yeah, definitely.
So we had a lot of, Ben and I had a lot of funny things. Anything, we had this joke early on, anything above the desk was my problem. Anything below the desk was his, which basically means he had to deal with wires.
Okay, I was trying to work that out.
Yeah, exactly. So wiring and hardware tech was all his bag.
Yeah.
If something required a phone call, so BT, if you know the internet didn't work or whatever, that would be my. I would have to do that.
So, communicate with people.
That's a very, seems like a really silly thing, and probably it was only a gag for the first year or two, and then of course as you're building a business, things get a lot more complex. But his area was certainly running the creative team. My area was much more client management. Account management and the strategic side.
Strategy.
And new business, which are three very different and big categories.
Yeah, massive.
So over time, obviously, those areas needed to be divided up.
Yeah.
Into more people.
When did you start employing people? What was the...
Well, we had freelance first. It was evident when freelance became permalance, as we love to call it, that needed to be a new employee. And we'd always keep a post-it note on the wall of who the next person, if we could, who would be the next person we would hire.
Yeah.
So we were very clear and deliberate about all of those hires. It was never a fast thing. In fact, if I look back, I would think, actually, sometimes I think we probably could have hired a little bit faster. But the slow growth was really, I'm not a fan of, I think it's socially quite irresponsible to bloat your company and then purge people through mass redundancies. I don't love that. So we were always...
And learn as well, don't you? Kind of, certainly with my business, that you're learning on how to manage people's careers and how to grow them and how to grow it in a really sustainable way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And how to be a manager.
Yeah.
These things are, I mean, maybe some people are gifted at that, but I would say it's, you learn over time. So I think adding 10 people really quickly, neither of us were really up for that. In fact, I want to find it. I'm pretty sure I have it somewhere, but we had a post-it note with a couple of the key things we wanted in our business.
Mm.
Quality over quantity was a big one. So say no to small, crappy churn stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Just take on fewer things that are really interesting. And another one of them was never be more than 15 people.
Interesting.
Which we are now 40.
So when did that get thrown out?
Well, not long before Ben said, I think I'm going to retire from design. And he's, that split, people are always very interested in that split. They're like, ooh, what's the story, Joy? Like, what happened? And I'm like, gosh, there was no happening.
How many years had you been together?
So I think, so where are we now? 14 years, I think it was.
Wow, okay.
Oh, well, even longer if you consider what was there before. I've known Ben for a very, very long time. Mm. And we're having lunch in April together. So we still keep very much in touch. And it was a really lovely thing. He sat me down. He said, basically I'm hanging out my boots. And I had such a clarity in that moment. There were two things I really wanted. Mm-hmm. One was I wanted DNCO to continue.
Yeah.
And to continue successfully.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was I didn't want to lose my friendship with Ben. And so I said to him, can we hire somebody who's going to help us through this in a way that we look back and we think, gosh, we did a really neat thing together. Didn't we have a good time? And I wanted to massively honor him. I would not be on this podcast with you today if it had not been for Ben.
Yeah.
Categorically.
I love that.
I really, I adore and admire him. And he's a really good pal. And he's been an incredible influence in my life generally.
Yeah.
And I wasn't done. For me, there was the sense like, I'm still running forward and it's cool. Like you can now clap from the sidelines and I want you to have a pile of money. But I want us all to feel at the end of it that no one's, in fact, the best advice we got from the management consultant who helped mediate isn't quite the right word. That feels very bellicose, but they sort of said to us, if you're both unhappy, then, this is it's a good deal.
So is that who you hired? You got a management consultant in to help you through it?
Exactly right. Yeah. So we hired SI Partners who did a great job. And a couple of things that they did for us. One, in fact, loads of really interesting things came out of that. One was they sat Ben down and said, what's a good number for you that helps you in your tick off some things in your life? And they sat me down and did the same thing. And they came to a number and it almost needed to be done that way and not in the multiples and valuation and all of that's crap because one of the founders was leaving. So we had to sort of do it in a way where we all thought that makes sense.
Yeah.
So they did that, which was really helpful for us. The other thing they did was introduce us to a thing called RACI, which a lot of people know. So responsible, accountable, consulted, and informed. And they sat the management team at DNCO, by the way, we were a small company, we were 20 then, but we did have a small management team. They sat us down, they put posters around the room with different areas of the business, accounting, new business, creative, I think 12 different boards.
Okay.
And they said, okay, now you guys are going to go around and you're going to say, who's like ultimately at the end of the day, whose job is that?
Yeah.
Who owns that? And who is in trouble if that's failing?
And you got everyone in the company to do this?
Actually, it was just the management team.
It was just the management team, okay.
And so two things happened there. One was we had to take the post-it notes off where Ben was and then put new names there because, we were figuring out where Ben was. We figured out new people we needed to hire. And the other one is that we figured out that I was accountable for some 10 or 11 out of the 12 different boards.
Wow.
And everyone was like, well, and I didn't do any of the putting up the post-it notes. So everyone else did this. And I thought, gosh, okay. this is interesting. This is an interesting result.
Yeah.
And Charles Fallon, who is one of the founders of SA Partners, took me out to lunch and said, Joy, if you ever want to be more than 20 people, you need to be accountable, not for 11 areas of your business. You need to be accountable for one. So let's have a few glasses of wine. And at the end of this lunch, you can pick one.
Good advice.
Which was really good advice. But I had such a visceral reaction to this and was really defensive and, no, I don't think you... Yeah,
interesting.
And I Charles found is a good friend, but I really did have and then I had a few glasses of wine and I looked at him and I said, okay, I think you're right. This is terrible. I'm a blocker.
So you're going to be a bottleneck on so many areas because one person can't do all that.
No, and not only that, just I'm not good at half of those things. So, that's stupid for a start.
But, yeah.
So pick the thing you're good at and find people that are great at those other things. So I think that was always going to make us much stronger. So I agreed by the end of that lunch to pick two things. And then I've later had this epiphany, like I should have zero accountability. And actually, in order to really build a very strong business, other people should be accountable and I can just advise and mentor and meet people and sit on panels and find squirrely, really weird ways of doing new business, come up with new things. For example, this year we're launching a place brand diagnostic. Have weird inputs that then result in different things coming into the business.
Yeah.
I would love to say to you today that I've got to the zero accountability place. I'm definitely not there.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that. That's really interesting. That's making me think that's that's kind of where I need to get to, definitely.
Well, I definitely recommend this. In fact, I think we are due now. We're twice the size that we were when we ran that race. See, I think we're due to do that again.
Yeah, okay.
To realign. It's such a useful exercise. Who's doing the doing? Who's the one who's saying you've done it wrong or you've done it right? Okay. And then who do you loop in, consult, to say, you know, just to bring fresh thinking, and you know, diversity of thought is really important. So getting lots of perspectives,
decision
making is really valuable. And then who are the people who decidedly should not be involved, and who just you just say, this is the decision that was made. And you know, that's in there are not very many situations I can think where that's super relevant, but it is sometimes
definitely
relevant. And actually, that clarity of roles is really useful and
really important
in a smaller organization. It's all hands to the pump everywhere. There is a lot of crossover, and when someone's on holiday, the other person's doing that bit. But and so early on, I kept the accounts. I did the management accounts. It was nuts. I'm sure if Sandeep is listening, he would say, I would not put Joy near the management accounts, you know, right now. But I think at some point you have to really recognize what you are particularly good at or passionate about, and then find people who just really excel at the other areas where you aren't. And then that's how you create a really super team.
Yeah, that's a really good way of even looking at the sort of culture of the organization and having a great culture together. I think that's quite an inspirational way to set up the business. So you do another one now, so that could be, who knows, what happens in the future.
Yeah, and for us, because we're slightly kookier perhaps in setup now, because we're owned by a trust, mm-hmm. and the trust is an employee-owned trust. So I no longer, in fact, nobody, no human being has any shares in Dancio, which is a really cool and very odd thing to think about.
But yeah.
We've become a fully employee-owned business. And what that means now from a accountabilities perspective is we have a slightly different way of operating. We're much more transparent. We share the finances. We have employee trust champions who once a year do a big survey of the team and talk about the future and how would we change it to be better. What are the things that, you know, really surfacing through the business, different ideas to become a better business? It's not top down.
So everyone's kind of got skin in the game type thing. It's the
for sure.
Yeah.
I certainly hope that's how people feel here. I think it is how people feel here, but it's a really purpose-led way of running a studio. And it's remarkable how much we've changed over the last 10 years, I would say, having celebrated 4 years as an employee-owned business. I think it carried us through the pandemic to have that team that was very united. And it was a hard time, I think, for most people.
So you went employee-owned basically as lockdown hit?
We were just before. Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Just before. So
it's an interesting time to do it. But I think you're right that keeping the culture and the team together is so important during that time.
Yeah, it was. It was helpful. I think it carried us through.
How do you have ways that you look at inspiring creativity at DMCO? What's the...
So we do actually. One of our colleagues, Harry Kingham, who is in the new business team, he brought in a great idea. And you know, we have always, for over the years, we've always tried to, you know, we've done private curated tours of museums, and I think inputs are really important. But Harry has really, we've talked about it for so long, but he really has done a great job of coordinating something that we call Talk Shop. So we have different studios come in, different individuals come in, photographers or people who run other agencies, artists.
That's a good idea.
We get everyone into this room that we're sitting in right now. It's standing room only, completely. I quite like the shoulder to shoulders rubbing together, everyone crammed in, lunch, and then someone comes in and does a really cool talk. So we have had lots of inspiring speakers, and I think that's one thing to do. I would say for me personally, the way to be inspired, the way I get inspired, one is reading a lot. I think it's so important to
read. Definitely, yeah.
Consuming digital is a way to read. It's a way to get inputs. But I personally don't think anything beats focus time over a period. You know, I'm lucky. You know, I say I'm lucky. Most people say they're not lucky if they have a commute. I think I'm lucky to have a commute because it's the time where I can read.
I completely agree. Yeah.
And to transform that view of, oh, I've got to get on the train to, oh, I'm getting on the train. This is my time for inputs. Those inputs, that pleasure of actually fueling your brain with different perspectives and different points of view. Sure, you can watch, you know, Diary of a CEO and get some of that injection of stuff. And I think there is a place for that. But I don't think anything beats a book. Okay. And the range of books, right? So novels is cool. Yeah. Novels give you all sorts of things. But honestly, I'm a giant fan of the, I mean, a lot of people call it the self-help genre.
Oh, me too.
But a bit of that, you know, some of it's crap. Honestly, some of it's like,
yeah, of
course. You go through it and you're like, that was totally,
not me.
That was totally crap. Mm. Some of it is whether it's, you know, are you breathing properly or how to run your business better or how to develop a marketing campaign or how to manage people. Like these inputs are priceless. Like there are people who have PhDs on networking, PhDs on all sorts of things. And I want to know what they
have. Yeah. So, was it you that recommended the book, The Rebel Ideas?
Yes, I love that book.
Yeah, yes. Thank you. I just remembered that now. It's so interesting.
Yeah, I love
all about diversity and the benefits of a diverse team and creative thinking. And absolutely. Yeah, it's brilliant. I bought it. Yeah, it's really good.
I just think I'm a big fan of Matthew Syed. I think he's great. I'm actually reading to my youngest son. He has a book called You Are Awesome, which sounds epically cheesy, but if you weren't aware, Matthew Syed was a 2-time Olympic table tennis, I don't know if it was champion or something, a British table tennis champion, and I'm probably completely mullering his CV, but he's an epic table tennis player. So he wrote this book on kind of how to be great, and it's a classic self-help book. I mean, I'm reading that to my kids. I'm already brainwashing him, but it's a lovely one that he said, I could have just been kid average, and instead I became kid awesome, and this is how I did it. And my son rolled his eyes and was like, oh God, mommy, what is this? What is this you're reading to me? And I was like, listen, I'm going to read you the introduction. And if you're not into it, we won't read it. Like, no commitment. But let me read you the introduction. And I read him the introduction, which was basically about how a boy got a table tennis table and then, you know, sucked at it. Basically, the dad just kicked his ass. And he just decided he could have put his bat down or he could have just dug his heels in and tried every day. And he picked, obviously, that avenue. And, you know, over time, he realized that even after just the first 3 or 4 hours, the improvement was, you know, marked. Uh-huh. And so, anyway, I don't know why I'm talking about him. But Matthew Syed, honestly, wrote Rebel Ideas. Rebel Ideas, just from any creative team, it really shows you how if you have a really homogenous team, you're reducing your ability to problem solve by quite a lot.
It starts talking about 9/11, doesn't it?
And that's phenomenal.
Yeah.
That's so
the
scary.
The FBI and the CIA's team at the time.
Yes, and they were all white, male, Protestant, Harvard-educated guys. They were literally...
Couldn't spot.
Yeah, they couldn't see the blind spots. They were too big. They had, you know, I think he says if they would have had one Middle Eastern person in that team, they would have been able to say, do you know what, this Bin Laden guy is in a cave and he looks like a, you know, like he looks like mendicant.
Yeah.
But actually, the reason he's doing that is because that is his religious expression of how serious he is. So he's probably a risk. He's actually also an oil billionaire. So that he's behaving like this means that he is
really serious.
Really serious.
It's not someone that's dropped out of society and not...
Exactly.
But it is really interesting, isn't it, that it is the CIA, isn't it? Not the FBI.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's the CIA was saying, we can't have token diversity in the CIA. The security of the nation is at risk here.
Right.
It's got to be the best people. And by that total lack of diversity ended up... Yeah, it's really interesting. It's a massive, horrendous disaster, but... It's a really interesting sort of thought that goes through the whole thing, really, isn't it?
It really is. The other really lovely one that he talks about is, and again, I mean, this is Joy's Shady Book of Facts, so it's worth reading the book, but and it sounds like you have. But the Japanese study, or there was a study that took, it was like an underwater scene, and the researchers asked the Japanese cohort to describe the scene, and an American cohort to describe the scene. And the Japanese were like, we're underwater. It looks like it's tropical. There's some seaweed. The seabed looks like this. The water is clear and clean. And Americans went yellowfish, bluefish, redfish, clownfish.
Pointed out all the actual things that were there.
All the actual things.
Objects, yes. It,
almost like consumerism.
Yeah.
You know, I can buy a yellow thing or I can buy a blue thing. They're picking out the things, the stuff, whereas the Japanese are much more contextual. And so you can see how those two perspectives are useful to have in a team.
Yeah, so both together, really powerful.
Entirely going to look at a problem from different perspectives. Yeah, which is great.
Yeah, oh, really interesting stuff. Can I ask you about the design industry and aspects of it? Do you feel like you're part of the design industry in the UK or globally or worldwide?
Categorically, yes.
Brilliant, that's good. What do you find challenging about it? What do you like about it?
So, gosh, there's a lot to love. I feel particularly in the sector that we deal with the most, the sectors that we deal with the most are the built environment. So we're actually affecting things that are going on in cities.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think our area, our nook of the world is a little bit overlooked. It's perhaps not as sexy as working with Nike and Coca-Cola and Google or whatever. But I think actually operating in the physical realm of where people live and where people work and hang out is really cool. So I feel very excited about the nook that we inhabit.
You get to come up with names for London Overground lines and stuff like that for the stations. It's really cool.
I wonder if that will be our biggest ever legacy piece, actually. So it's
really cool, isn't it?
So I'm proud.
We'll be there for a long time. That's massive. I mean, lots of things you do well, but...
Hopefully forever, Claire.
Absolutely, fingers crossed. Yeah, forever.
fingers crossed. But in terms of what do I find challenging, I think the traditional thing a founder might say about what they find challenging, especially after some growth, is managing people. And I actually want to put that to the side and say, I decidedly don't think that's the answer. Managing people, sure, it's part of the job. And as I said before, I don't think it's something you're born with. Managing, you have to learn and you have to experiment and go, oh God, you did not perform very well as a manager or as an inspiring leader there, Joy. Like, you could do better next time. But generally, I would say, you know, people are working hard and they want to do great things. I think it's so important as a leader and as a manager to assume always in the first instance that people are wanting to do great things and they're wanting to work hard and they're wanting to achieve and not the, oh, people are such a drag to manage. So I just want to, I hear all the time people say, oh, management is hard, isn't it? And I'm like, you know, managing is a privilege, man. These are like, people are putting their careers in your hand. And
I'm with you, totally.
If you're not meeting that challenge, then I think that's disappointing. So I would say right now, I'm not thinking that managing people is hard. I'm thinking it's a huge responsibility and a pleasure.
Yeah.
And that people are inherently good. The thing I would say is really hard right now in the industry generally is running a profitable company while there's a cost of living crisis, while clients are putting screws on budgets, and an area that's going to sound really difficult to say out loud, but with a generation that is generally, their resilience is low, and mental health is a crisis.
Absolutely.
And then saying, come on, everyone, let's go, let's do great stuff, and let's achieve, and let's make a profitable company. Those variables together, in my 18 years of running just this company, it's never been more challenging. Those are hard things. You want to do good by people.
Yeah.
You want to do good by your clients. And, you know, at the end of it, you're hoping you're not going bust. And I'm just going to say that's hard right now.
Definitely.
I think business owners are waking up I don't own this business, the trust does, but let's pretend I was one. I think they're waking up every morning with that just seemingly inexorable challenge is absolutely at the forefront of everything they're thinking. They want to do great for clients, but the clients, I think, are spending less because it's been hard. The capital markets, it's a difficult time for budgets. And people, you know, their productivity perhaps is a little bit low for various reasons. Mm-hmm. Some of them are really very real and not absolutely having a criticism on people. I think those the reasons for resilience being low and the reasons for mental health being issues being they're very real. That's not a, you know, it's not like, oh, that generation, there's, you know.
Yeah, no, not at all.
None of that. I think these are real issues. Nonetheless, they make it hard. And we've seen over the last 4 years, certainly pandemic related and other, people just say, I've had enough. I can't do this anymore. It's too difficult. I can't square the circle. So I think we're hanging in there. We're, you know, having a good time still, and we're producing work and gaining new markets, certainly North America, which we're really proud of. But I would say very much that it's never been more complex than it is right now.
Yeah. Yes. I think that's a very good way of putting it. Absolutely.
The creative industry needs to be supported. You know, it needs that this country, especially UK PLC, is so massively fueled by the creative industries. It's a huge industry.
Huge, absolutely.
And the government has, I think, a massive responsibility to make sure that it's keeping this industry very well supported.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that's issue close to my heart. It's like 1 in 8 jobs in London now in the creative industries, which is a very wide term, but
yeah,
very much the creative industries.
It's huge.
It needs to be taught in schools. It needs to be taught. Yeah, it's a big area.
And as you know very well, that area has dwindled massively. I see massively. My own kid's school. It's been, you know, half an hour of art and half an hour of DT a week, if they're lucky.
It's really sad. You know, in this year in Tower Hamlets, there are 27 kids studying art, A-level. Just 27.
Wow. That's,
yeah, so many children doing A-levels, and it's something that hopefully will get sorted out with a new government and stuff like that. But again, different podcast probably. So, can I ask you finally about, have you got any top tips for young people starting out today?
Yes, definitely. I think my top tip, I would have two. My top tip would be, set yourself apart by getting stuff done. And it seems like such a simple thing, but if I look at the team, the people who are the most memorable are the ones who say, gee, I'll sort that out. I'll jump on that. I'll get on that. And a lot of my colleagues, I think almost probably every one of my colleagues will know that the sweetest words that I ever hear are, oh, joy, I've already done that.
I love that.
I've finished that already.
Yes.
When I say, Claire, have you done that thing? It's like, I've already done that, Joy.
Yeah.
That was done last week. It's like, oh. So it's, if we think about a business that's really firing on all cylinders, if you had everybody who's just getting stuff done.
And such good advice. No one's ever said that before on the podcast.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Get stuff done. It's, yeah, absolutely.
Get stuff done. And of course, look, if you're a young person and you hit a wall,
yeah,
there are multiple things you can do in that moment. Google it. What's the shortcut for blah, blah, blah? I hear it all the time in the studio. You know, what's the shortcut again? What's the shortcut for whatever, layering, duh. And it's like, you know, that's a quick Google. Like, honestly, ChatGPT now solves a lot of those
definitely
basic issues. I'm not saying don't speak to each other. And then if you have a creative block where you have three different ideas, you don't know which one to push forward, or you want to turn three ideas into 8 ideas, you know, talking to people is important, yeah, but get it done. I think not get it finished, just move the ball forward.
Yeah.
Move the ball forward. I would say is hugely important. I recognize a lot of people want to build this personal brand. You know, my personal brand on Instagram, my personal brand on TikTok. I want people who are throwing themselves on improving this brand.
You know, definitely
pushing this company forward. So I think that get things done. It's a small, seemingly silly thing, but I think if I look around, those are the people I want in my boat. My lifeboat are the ones who, you know, reliable. You know, throwing themselves on the grenade or just getting stuff done.
Very important.
The other thing is, and this is perhaps it's going to sound a little bit controversial. If I were a young person today, I would not work from home.
Yes, I can totally see where you're coming from.
I would not
work
from home.
I can't do it.
You can't do it. I think inputs are so crucial when you're young. You need to overhear conversations. You need to look over other people's shoulders to see what they're working on. You need to walk past bookstores, record stores, you need to go to gigs, go to the pub, you need to have a chat, the proverbial water cooler, Those things are really important, and you do not get that at home.
That's it. The life that you've just described there sounds, in my head, very rich and full of colour.
Yeah.
If you're just at home and you can't... I think it's a really easy habit to get into, of waking up in the morning and thinking, I'll go in tomorrow, and then going, oh, maybe I'll go in the next day. And it's kind of... And I know some people are very good at it, but it's certainly not me.
Yeah. And I mean, there are, of course, there are lots of reasons to... I've got a family. Mm. I commute in... That I love to work from home, but yeah. I certainly feel it in myself. When I have worked from home, I feel a disconnection from my colleagues.
Me too.
I just look at some of my colleagues who have to write really long explanations on Slack. I'm like, God, that was a 2-second chat in the studio.
Really good point.
And you don't get tone. Tone gets misconstrued.
Yeah.
When things, then tensions arise. And then if you have that tension, you then have to spend time explaining, oh my gosh, I didn't mean that. So I think all of that is just, it just goes away if you just, and those chances, those opportunities to sit next to a boss or a manager and just learn.
Yeah.
It's, you're not getting that over Slack. You're getting that
in the studio. It's that sitting next to someone and hearing what someone says, and then you wouldn't call a Zoom meeting about that, but just the way someone phrases something called the,
Or, you know, you get a senior person, we have some incredible new talent in the studio, to get someone that's had lots of interesting experience to walk past and say, oh, that's really interesting. Have you thought about this, you know, or have you thought about pushing it in that direction? And, oh, I saw, you know, actually the thing on your screen is really good, but, you know, I've seen this other thing that is you might want to be aware of. If you're alone at home, there's none of that happening. I recognize that there are a lot of reasons why people want to protect working from home. As a young person, I would say if you want to excel, if you want to learn, you need to be around people. You need to be around people you can learn from.
I'm with you.
Collaborate, communicate, go out, have fun, go out to the pub or, you know, for a matcha, I don't care, but just like communicate with people and get as many inputs as you can.
Definitely. I'm with you. That's really good advice. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's been really, really fun.
Always a pleasure.